Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. It is May 13th. That's a Tuesday. And we're going to get into respiratory chapter. We just have maybe one slide left with cardiac output, blood flow, blood pressure. Sign-in sheet is going around. All lectures are online. Study guides are online. So let's take a look at the schedule and see what we need to finish up. So we are going to get into respiratory physiology today. And probably next time, renal physiology, and maybe even next time, some more renal physiology. I'm not sure how that's going to go. Maybe I can talk a little bit about that exam figure in the reproductive system. And that might be about it. All right, so don't forget, on the test is going to be 13, 14, 16, 17, a little bit of 18, and a little bit of 20. So that's the deal with the schedule. Anybody have a question with the schedule? Yeah, so don't forget about this 13, because we didn't cover that on the last test, right? Okay. All right, so let's finish up. Cardiac output, blood flow, blood pressure. And what were we talking about last time? Well, last time we did... Oh, you have a question. Yeah. No. There's just the online material for the weekly assignments and in your study guide. Okay, so study guide, it tells you what end of chapter questions I like, what exam figures I like. Okay, and as a matter of fact, what's digestive system 18? I don't know if I like any pictures in 18. Maybe one. Maybe I pulled out one. But for reproductive system, there's one fantastic figure that shows the profiles of various hormones in the female body and how they change during the ovarian cycle. And what are the changes in the uterus? What are the changes in the ovaries in that monthly cycle? So I really hope to get through that figure. What is 17? I don't know what chapter 17 is. What is it? Do you know the name of it?
No, I mean
urinary. Yeah, we'll cover urinary. Yeah, yeah. Not today, though, because today we're going to cover respiratory. So, any other questions? Okay. So, last time we were talking about some cardiovascular, and we learned something about blood pressure. How is blood pressure? What parameters affect blood pressure? I'll give you a hint. There's three. Three parameters that can affect blood pressure. And are they directly related or indirectly related? They're all directly related. So if they go up, blood pressure goes up. And cardiac output. Cardiac output goes up, blood pressure goes up. I like it. And stroke volume. Yeah, stroke volume goes up, blood pressure goes up. And then one last thing, which is not really intuitive. It is the total peripheral resistance. Yeah, resistance of blood vessels increases, blood pressure goes up. Okay, so you can just memorize that equation, but be able to think about it, be able to use that equation in your mind, and if that equation doesn't stick, then go ahead and derive it from those two really simple equations. And that is blood flow is equal to what? Pressure divided by resistance, and blood flow through the heart is just is cardiac output, and that's stroke volume times heart rate. Right? So those are pretty simple. Just put those two together, and you'll find how pressure is related. Okay. The other thing is there are mechanisms that help control blood pressure. There is a very fast mechanism that can change, that can regulate your blood pressure from moment to moment, and then there's a long-term mechanism for regulating blood pressure over days or weeks, maybe even months. And I do want you to know that the names of those two things. What about the one that's responsible for long-term regulation of blood pressure? Renin, angiotensin, aldosterone mechanism. Yeah, so some of those things are enzymes, some of those things are hormones, so make sure you know what an enzyme is, what a hormone is, and in order for a hormone to exert its effect, what does the target tissue have to have? Yeah, it's got to have a receptor for that hormone, right? And if it has a receptor, then that hormone can change the physiology of that cell somehow. Okay. All right, so that's long-term regulation. What about short-term regulation of blood pressure? Yeah, baroreceptor reflux. So remember, long-term regulation has to do with hormones. Short-term has to do with nerves, nervous activity, because nerves can exert their effects very rapidly, but the duration of their action is pretty short. So this is an excellent kind of system to use for short-term regulation of blood pressure. And that's what we have on this slide right here. Right, this kind of shows us the baroreceptor reflux. And maybe I was going over this last time. I think maybe I started to go over this. All right, so what do we see? What do we see on this figure? What do we see? Come on, Arrow, I thought I told you to stay put. I'll do it again. Visible. Okay. All right, so, well, we see the brain, right? We see cerebral cortex. And then we see something that looks like the hypothalamus. And then we see some brain stem, medulla oblongata, then we see spinal cord, and then we see a sympathetic chain ganglia, so we know what level of the spinal cord this is. So if we see sympathetic chain, what level of the spinal cord are we looking at? It is thoracolumbar, so it's probably some thoracic region, because that's how sympathetic outflow leaves the central nervous system. All right, so this is in particular sympathetic outflow. And also we have some nerves that are leaving the medulla, and that's part of the cranium. So what kind of nerves leave the cranium? What kind of nerves? Typically we call those cranial nerves. You're aware of that. And in particular, some of you actually know what cranial nerve this is that goes to the heart, and that is the vagus cranial nerve number 10. Right. Okay, so this is just some quick anatomy. So how does this feedback loop start? Well, it starts with a receptor, right? So all response loops start with a receptor which can measure some kind of stimulus. So the receptors are in the carotid sinus and the arch of the aorta. And so these we would call carotid bodies. Up over here we would call these aortic bodies. And these can measure pressure, because when the pressure increases in these vessels, they have enough elasticity that they will expand and stretch. And so these really are stretch receptors. And when they start to stretch, they increase the frequency and action potentials, right, to the medulla. We see them going to the medulla. And here is the cardioregulatory center in the medulla. And I think last time we said that the cardioregulatory center has some important information stored in it all the time. And that is the set point of what the pressure should be in these blood vessels. All right, so the stimulus is a change in blood pressure, and we can say maybe a decrease in blood pressure. That's really good. Like if you were to stand up right now, your blood pressure would decrease. These aortic bodies and carotid bodies would send signals to the medulla oblongata. That information would be compared with the set point, and then the medulla knows that your blood pressure is dropping below normal. So how would this medulla then, or the cardioregulatory center, maintain homeostasis? By doing something to increase blood pressure, right? Because that was the initial stimulus, a decrease. So the regulatory center would send out signals via the sympathetic nervous system to the SA node, and that's going to increase heart rate. What happens to pressure when you increase heart rate? It goes up, right? It's directly related to pressure. Sympathetic nerves also go to the ventricle, and it makes the heart beat stronger, so the stroke volume increases. So if stroke volume increases, what happens to pressure? It goes up as well. So heart rate, that stroke volume increase, so cardiac output increases. But these sympathetic nerves go one more place, not shown on this diagram. You might want to draw it in. It goes to blood vessels, and it causes those blood vessels to vasoconstrict. What happens to resistance in a blood vessel when it vasoconstricts? Does it go up or down? It goes way up, right? According to the fourth power rule of the radius. And so if the resistance increases in those vessels, not shown on this diagram, again, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up, because it's just directly related to pressure, right? So all three of those things will increase blood pressure when it starts to drop. And that's really nice, because when you stand up, you won't pass out, right? Because that baroreceptor reflex is going to boost your blood pressure back up to the set point. And when it does, we call that homeostasis, because the response subtracts from the initial stimulus. All right, so this is a handy diagram. Don't know if I have this as an exam figure or not. The other thing that's important on this diagram is this carotid sinus. Can you tell me where the carotid sinus exists in our body? It says common carotid artery. That's a good one of the landmarks. What are two other landmarks? The carotid sinus is right at the bifurcation of the common carotid into the internal carotid and the external carotid. And that's in your neck. So that bifurcation, and when you look right here, there's a little bit of a swelling. That's the normal shape of this artery. And because that's the normal shape, when blood gets squirted up into this region, it has a lot of funny turbulence. It exerts a very funny pressure to the walls of these blood vessels. And over time, it causes damage to the carotid sinus. And that damage can result in the formation of plaques or thrombus, which can break off. And if those plaques go into the internal carotid, where does that thrombus go? Right to the brain, right? Causing a stroke. And so that's mostly how a lot of people get strokes, because of disease within the, what's this area right here? It's called the carotid sinus. And pretty much all day long, in an ultrasound department, they're doing ultrasounds of people's necks looking at this particular region. This is probably the most imaged region in anybody's body, in the human population, looking for disease, cardiovascular disease. All right, so that's another reason why it's important. Not only important because it can measure pressure, but because it diseases up very quickly in life. All right, so here we have probably a nice response loop, baroreceptor reflex. And is it short-term or long-term regulation of blood pressure? Short-term, right? Because it's a nervous mechanism. So going from a lying down position to standing, right? When you do that, blood is not going to return to the heart. Well, it will return to the heart from your head and your shoulders, but not so much from everything below the level of the heart. So if we decrease venous return because we're standing up, what happens to end diastolic volume if not a lot of blood is returning to the heart? Then it goes down. The heart isn't stretched quite so much, and then stroke volume goes down. Fill in this arrow right here. What's causing this? It's a really nice relationship that you should know. What causes this jump from end diastolic volume to decreased stroke volume? Contractility of the heart is decreasing, and that is the Frank-Starling law of the heart that says when end diastolic volume increases, the stretch of the myocardium increases. That is an intrinsic regulation for causing the heart to beat more vigorously. Frank-Starling law. All right, and is stroke volume, as it's going down, does it relate to cardiac output? Yeah, because cardiac output is equal to stroke volume times heart rate, right? So you should be able to follow that. So cardiac output goes down, and if stroke volume goes down, you could probably just jump automatically to blood pressure. What's going to happen to blood pressure? It's going to go down because that's in that nice equation you know about. So that is the stimulus, the decrease in blood pressure. You won't have so much blood going to the brain, not so much oxygen going to the brain. You might pass out. You might get a little dizzy. But as the pressure is decreasing, fortunately, you have receptors for that pressure, right? They're called baroreceptors. Name the two locations where you have those baroreceptors. Yeah, carotid sinus and aortic arch. Right? They're stretch receptors. They send information. So this is the afferent pathway into the integration center, the medulla oblongata. This is the cardioregulatory center. And since this is a drop in blood pressure, okay, we would want to get the blood pressure back up by adjusting heart rate, stroke volume, and resistance. And we can do that by increasing sympathetic outflow. Right, and that will cause vasoconstriction of our arterioles, which means the resistance goes up. And if resistance increases, what can you tell me about blood pressure? It goes up as well, right? Because you know that equation. And if heart rate increases because of sympathetic stimulation, what happens to cardiac output? It goes up. And when cardiac output goes up, of course, blood pressure is going to increase as well. All right, something funny, a little bit funny about this diagram. At least this diagram had sympathetic nerves going to blood vessels. That's nice. But it's missing an arrow. Okay, this is adjusting the rate, which is a chronotropic effect of the heart, right? Sympathetic is a positive chronotropic effect. But what other thing on the heart is the sympathetic nervous system also controlling? You should maybe draw another arrow right here. Not just heart rate, but, yeah, contractility, force of contraction, right? So that means stroke volume goes up. So cardiac, the heart rate goes up, stroke volume goes up, What does that mean? Ah, cardiac output goes way up, which then brings blood pressure back up to normal, maintaining homeostasis. So make sure you can follow through this diagram, this flow diagram. Is this an exam figure? Does anybody know? I don't know, but that's okay because I'm not taking the test, but you guys are. So take a look at those study guides. All right, any other questions on this chapter? Because that's the last slide. Probably the most important equation is pressure is equal to heart rate times stroke volume times resistance of blood vessels. Okay. All right, so then that's going to get us into the respiratory chapter. There's the respiratory chapter. It is an exam figure. Fantastic. All right, so you can memorize it, but it would probably really be useful to understand what all those little steps are between those little the little diagram boxes, because that will be the best for you to understand what's going on. Okay, respiratory physiology. So we're not going to spend too much time looking at respiratory structures because that's just anatomy. We're going to be more interested in mechanics of breathing, some disorders, factors that affect ventilation. Ventilation is just breathing in and out, which is a little bit different than respiration, right? Because respiration could also mean all those biochemical pathways that produce ATP that require oxygen, like aerobic respiration. Ah, that's respiration, right? So ventilation is just the mechanical movement of air in and out of your lungs. What controls that? How do things move around in the blood? How does oxygen get around? And how does CO2 get around in your body? Okay, so respiration includes ventilation, O2, oxygen utilization, but we spent a couple weeks on that way back when, looking at oxidative phosphorylation, for instance. It also involves gas exchange in the lungs and also gas exchange in the tissues. So anywhere, where can exchange take place when we're talking about a blood vessel? Where can exchange take place? Only in a capillary. Yeah, so capillaries in the lungs and then capillaries in the rest of your body, systemic capillaries. So we got pulmonary capillaries and we got systemic capillaries. All right, so that's exchange between blood and tissues and also between tissues and blood. And oxygen is necessary, of course, for oxidative phosphorylation. Now these gases, CO2 and oxygen, just move passively by diffusion. What does that mean? What does diffusion mean? How does oxygen move? How does it go? From high concentration to low concentration. That's the only way it can get around in our body. Same thing for carbon dioxide. It can only go from high concentration to low. So let's think, I don't think I have a slide that shows this, but let's think about oxygen. Your body needs oxygen. So where should oxygen be at a high concentration? Out in the air or inside your body? Okay, that was a trick question, but you got it right. Because oxygen can't be high in your body because oxygen then would leave your body. So oxygen is high in the air, low in your body so that it goes in. All right, even though your body needs oxygen. What about CO2? Is it high in the air or high in your body? It's high in the body, right? And then it leaves your body because it's almost zero concentration in the air. Even though you don't want a buildup of CO2 in your body, that's still the highest place, and it will leave your body because there's hardly any in the air. So that moves by diffusion. All right, well, here is a lung. You know, we got two of them, trachea, bronchioles, and then these bronchioles bifurcate into smaller and smaller tubes. Most of these have cartilage around them. Why does an airway have cartilage around them? Anybody know that? Why that is? As opposed to the esophagus. Doesn't have any cartilage holding it open. But I think you had a really good idea, because sometimes when we breathe out, we have to compress our chest like that. And when we compress our chest, these tubes would collapse. And when they collapse, air can't move through them. Right? So they're held open all the time, even though you're pressurizing your chest. And then air can leave. So that's the reason why that cartilage is there. Some other airways don't have cartilage. These are what we call bronchioles. Bronchioles have smooth muscle. And just like any kind of tube, that smooth muscle can adjust the radius of this tube, which then adjusts the flow of air in and out of these different spaces, right? Because that increases or decreases resistance. And then these little sacs right here, these are alveoli. That's just a general name for a little pocket in anatomy. This is where air flows into, and surrounding this alveolus is a network of capillaries and also a network of elastic fibers. Well, now, what kind of fiber is an elastic fiber? Why is it pretty cool, an elastic protein? Because you can stretch it and then let go. What's going to happen? Is it just going to stay there? It's going to recoil. It's going to snap back, right? So that's one really good thing about this alveolus. When we inhale, we can stretch that alveolus out. And then when we relax, what happens to those elastic fibers? It pulls that alveolus back down to that initial shape. And when it does, that helps force air out of these alveoli. Okay. So we're looking at an alveolus right here. So we went way microscopic. Here's a capillary, and there's a lot of capillaries around every alveolus. And you can see the wall of the alveolus right here. And you can consider that an endothelium or an epithelium. And what kind of epithelium does this look like to you? How would you classify this epithelium? Yeah, it's a nice simple squamous epithelium. Squamous because these cells are really flat and there's only one layer. And that kind of epithelium is specialized for what kind of purpose? Exchange, right? Because things can diffuse across that space because it's very, very small. It's a very, very short distance. And so oxygen and carbon dioxide can diffuse across the wall of the alveolus through a very thin interstitial space. And actually, it's kind of exaggerated in this condition. It's not nearly that thick in real life. And then the wall of a capillary, and you know that a capillary is specialized for exchange because what kind of endothelium does it have? A simple squamous endothelium, right? Just like the wall of the alveolus. All right, so two very thin walls. Sometimes we call these three structures the respiratory membrane, because that's the membrane that oxygen has to move from the air in the alveolus into the blood, or CO2 in the blood into the air in the alveolus, right? Respiratory membrane. Okay, so we have about 300 million of these things. Can't quite see them with your naked eye. And so in order for exchange to take place, we need a doorway for things to enter or leave. What's another way that you could think of a doorway? And that is surface area, right? We measured the surface area of that door right there. When the surface area increases, what happens to exchange? Just directly related, it goes up. Okay. So if we were to take all of these alveoli, think of them as being an orange, and we want to calculate what the surface area is, we would just peel the orange and put it on a table, flatten it all out, and make sure all the edges match up, right? And then we could just measure the width of that peel and the height and know what the surface area is. But for these alveoli, if we want to figure out what the surface area for exchange of your lung is, we would have to take all those alveoli, flatten them out on a table, right, and then get another one, flatten it out on a table, and put all 300 million down on a table, and then measure the width and the height, multiply those two numbers together to get what the surface area is. And here is what it is, 60 by 80. Okay, it could be anywhere between 60 to 80 square meters. I don't know if anybody knows what that is, but that's about half of a tennis court. That's the surface area for exchange, if you were to flatten out all those alveoli. So it's pretty amazing that that tennis court has been folded up, basically, and put into your thorax, but that doorway is still there. And I think it's really a wonderful idea. I'm really partial to that idea. I think it's great because there's no reason why that I could ever think of why I would want to be as wide as a tennis court, or tall as half of a tennis court. Okay, so folding it up makes perfect sense to me. Any questions at all? Did I see a hand go up? Okay. All right, so there's that respiratory membrane. When we look at this alveolus, I see a couple cells. I see maybe three types of cells. I see the cell that makes up the wall of the alveolus. We call that a type 1 alveolar cell. Then I see a type 2 alveolar cell, and it's actually part of the wall. And then I see a macrophage. And a macrophage, you can see all these little foot processes sticking out of it. This is a shapeshifter cell. It was a monocyte at one time in your blood, and it crawled out of the capillary right here into the alveolus, so it can get really small and squeeze through really small spaces. And it can look for foreign substances in this alveolus and even in the interstitial space. It will recognize it because it's not the proper antigen on the surface of the cell. It will engulf it, and then it might even bring that antigen into, could be a bacteria, into your body so that the rest of your immune system can recognize it and then build antibodies against it or other kinds of cells that can kill that bacteria. So a macrophage is sort of like a cleaner-upper. It cleans up the alveolus so it doesn't plug up with bacteria and debris, but it also helps activate the immune system as well. All right, so what's the job of this alveolar cell here? All right, the type 1, you know, just helps make up the respiratory membrane. And this type 2 cell has a special function. Okay, special function. It secretes a substance into the watery fluid that is right on the surface of the alveolus. And what could you tell me about water? Is it slippery or is it sticky? Sticky or slippery? Yeah, if you're walking on the linoleum floor or something, you could slip on it, right? But I need to change your impression of what water is like. Okay, I'm going to try to convince you that it is really, really sticky. So here I have a couple transparencies, and if I put them together like this and hold on to one of them, all right, and then, or if I hold on to both of them and let go of one, what's going to happen? They're going to fall, and I don't want to lose it, so let's see, I'll just try to catch it like that, right? So it just fell down, just like that. But if we want to glue these two transparencies together, where are we going to find glue? Just in a water faucet right here, because I said water is really sticky. Now, let's see if that is true. Okay, so only water on this. I'm going to put these two transparencies together, like so. All right, I'll make sure that they're right up against each other. And now I'm going to hold on to both of them, and I'm going to let go of one. The one that I let go, is it going to fall down? It's glued together, right, because there's water in there. And as a matter of fact, I want somebody to actually pull on one. Okay, and I would have you do it. Okay, but here's the one I want you to pull on. It just has that little bit right there. Oh, you got to pull. Oops. Is it really sticky?
Yeah.
Really, really sticky, right? Okay, so water is a fantastic glue if you use it as a glue. But since it's inside this alveolus, right, if it was just left to be water, guess what happened to the walls of this alveolus? When they touch each other, they would get stuck together. And then air couldn't flow in there. So that type 2 alveolar cell secretes a compound that acts like a detergent, and it breaks all those hydrogen bonds between the water molecules. And when it does so, then it breaks what we call surface tension. It gets rid of surface tension so that these alveoli can expand, and that compound is called surfactant. So a type 2 alveolar cell secretes surfactant so that this alveolus can expand. Some people don't produce surfactant, and then they have trouble breathing because these walls of the alveoli get stuck together. That's respiratory distress syndrome. When somebody's born prematurely, these type 2 alveolar cells aren't mature, they don't produce surfactant, and those premature babies can't breathe either. They can't inflate these alveoli. So what do we do for a premature baby that has way decreased pulmonary function because they're not producing surfactant and all their alveoli are stuck together, the walls of the alveoli are stuck together? What do we do to help them? We put them in an incubator, right, and we increase the oxygen concentration inside the incubator, and then, and what's the driving force for diffusion? It's just a concentration gradient. So if we increase the concentration of oxygen in the air the infant is breathing, then more oxygen enters the body, even though the alveoli aren't functioning properly. It's a way to compensate for that. All right, so know something about that surfactant fluid. It acts like a glue. Okay, the bronchial tree, I think you know something about thoracic cavity. What separates the thoracic cavity from the abdominal cavity? Yeah, the diaphragm. The diaphragm is the most important muscle for breathing, and when it contracts, you inhale. When it relaxes, it has elastic properties. It goes back to its original shape. When it's at rest, it's shaped like a dome. When it's contracted, it flattens out. All right, and when it relaxes, it goes back to a dome once again. Okay, so here we have a nice cross-section. through the thorax, and I see some lung. We're not going to pay attention to the heart or the esophagus or trachea. What I really want you to focus on here is the membrane that surrounds the lung. Now, the outside of the lung is not open to the outside world. The inside is, but not the outside. And so what kind of membrane lines a cavity that is not open to the outside world? That's a serous membrane. Remember, there's two kinds. There's mucus, which is a membrane lining some kind of cavity open to the outside world, like oral cavity, reproductive cavity, urinary tract, right? Digestive tract. Those are all mucus membranes. But the membrane around the lungs, we call that the pleural membrane, is a serous membrane. And how many parts does a serous membrane have? Mucus only has one part to it. It's not very complicated. What about serous membrane? It's got three, right? All right, what are these three? There is part on the wall of that cavity, and we call that the parietal division. So here's the parietal pleura. Then there's another part of that serous membrane that's right on the surface of the lungs. And we call that the visceral pleura, right? Because this is a visceral organ, and that membrane is right on this visceral organ, so we call that the visceral pleura. And then the third part is the pleural cavity. There's a space between those membranes. Okay, so those are three important things. Sometimes the space inside the alveoli is called the intrapulmonary space, and the space is between the lung and the wall. Sometimes we call that the intrapleural space. Intrapleural is here. Intrapulmonary is inside the lung. And we're going to have to take a look at some of those pressures to understand how it is that we breathe. Okay. So, the way that we breathe is that we enlarge the size of the thorax. So our rib cage actually expands laterally. And as our rib cage expands laterally, do you think it would be a good idea for these lungs to be glued up against the wall of the thorax? Or should they be able to separate? Okay, so think of a bellows. You ever work a bellows maybe to start a fire? It's kind of a wedge-shaped thing with a nozzle coming out. And when you open the bellows up like that, which way does air go? It goes in, right? When you increase the volume, air goes in. And when you decrease the volume, which way does air go? It goes out. Okay, so when we enlarge the thoracic, when we enlarge the thorax, it's like opening the bellows up, okay, and then air goes in our chest. Now, the lung right here, do you think that should be attached to the thoracic wall so that when the wall expands, the lung goes with it? Or do you think it would be a good idea to detach the lung from the thorax? So when we expand the thorax, the lung just stays the same shape. Should the shape of the lung expand with the wall of the thorax, or should it just stay the same, even though the thorax is moving? Okay, it should follow the thorax, right? It should just go, the volume should increase and decrease. So, in this particular case, you think you should have surfactant in this pleural space, or something more like water that acts like a glue? Yeah, you'd need something like water, something that acts more like a glue, that glues the surface of the lung to the thoracic wall so that when the wall changes shape, so does the lung. So on the internal spaces, those alveoli, you don't want them sticking together. You need surfactant, but you don't want surfactant in this pleural space because then the lung is going to detach from the wall of the thorax, and you can breathe all day long, but air's not going to go into the lungs if it doesn't expand. Okay, so another important thing about water. All right, some aspects about ventilation. All right, so how does diffusion go once again? From high concentration to low concentration. Yeah.
So in the internal spaces in the pleural cavity, is what's in that making it water?
Basically just water.
Water?
Yeah. Yeah, it's just water. No surfactant. No surfactant. Your book does mention that there is that fluid in here so that the lung can slide a little bit along the wall of the thorax. So it does have a little bit of a lubricating property, but you can't get rid of that surface tension because then the lung won't be glued to the wall of the thorax. That's an important thing. Okay. So it's more like water rather than surfactant. Okay. So diffusion. High concentration to low concentration. What about a fluid? How is that going to move? Like in this room, how would air as a fluid, how is it going to move in this room? kind of like the fusion. It's going to go from a high pressure to a low pressure, right? Just like blood. High pressure in arteries, low pressure in veins, and that blood flows through that vessel to get from high pressure to low. All right, so ventilation has to have changes in pressure of the lung in order for air to move in and out of your lungs. And the way that that happens is by changing lung volumes. All right, so air moves from high to low pressure, and your lungs are very compliant, so small changes in pressure cause big changes in the volume of the lungs. All right, so let's define a couple pressures. The pressure inside the lung, I mentioned this already. The pressure inside the alveoli is what we call the intrapulmonary pressure inside the lung. And the pressure that's in this pleural space right here is what we call the intrapleural space. And remember, we want the lungs to stick up against the wall of the thorax. So where do you think you would want to have relatively high pressure? In the pleural space right here, or inside the lungs? The intrapulmonary space or the intrapleural space? Where should there be high pressure in order to force the lungs up against the wall of the thorax? Remember, things go from high pressure to low. So if we want the lungs to expand whenever we expand the chest, there has to be high pressure inside the lungs compared to this pleural space. It should have low pressure, right? And that's also going to push the lungs up against the wall of the thorax, and that's going to work in concert with that stickiness of water that helps glue it in there. Okay. So that intrapleural space has that sticky water solution. Okay, so let's look at the intrapulmonary pressure and the intrapleural pressure. And we got two cases, inspiration and expiration. And atmospheric pressure, not on this slide, is about 760 millimeters of mercury. We see some little numbers here, like +3, -3. These are deviations from atmospheric pressure. So if the pressure is +3 on this diagram, what would be the pressure really? It would be 763, right? And if it was -3, then it would be 757, okay? So we add this to atmospheric pressure, but we just want to look at the relative pressure between these different compartments. And how is something going to want to move from a high pressure, like +3, to a lower pressure, like -3, right? So as this minus number gets bigger, that means lower pressure. As that negative number gets smaller, that means a little bit higher pressure. When it turns positive and it gets even more positive, like from 3 to 5, that's even higher pressure, right? So pressure is just on that number line. And one thing we want to look at is the transmural pressure. Transmural pressure is the pressure that is across the lung. And it's the wall of the lung proper, not through the thorax and everything, but just across the lung. So it's the intrapulmonary pressure minus the intrapleural pressure. What is that? Let's go back to a previous slide if I can. All right, so that transpulmonary pressure is the difference between the pressure in the pleural space compared to what we have in the alveoli. So on inspiration, we see that because we change the volume of our chest, the intrapulmonary pressure gets to be about -3. So that's lower than atmospheric pressure, and the intrapleural pressure changes as well. It gets to be -6. So how are we going to find that transpulmonary pressure? We subtract these two numbers, so if we have -3 and minus a -6, then we have a +3 pressure, millimeters of mercury. So we have 3 millimeters of mercury right going across the wall of the lung. So what is that going to do to the lungs? Is that going to deflate the lung, or is that going to inflate? Yeah, if there's high pressure inside the lung, that's going to push the lung up against the wall of the thorax. All right, so that's what happens during inspiration. All right, we still have a +3, a transpulmonary pressure. On expiration, now the intrapulmonary pressure inside the lungs becomes positive because we're decreasing the volume of our chest, right? And the pressure in the intrapleural space increases a little bit, but it doesn't go to zero. It stops at -3. To find out what the pressure difference is between those two spaces, again, we subtract these numbers. So we've got 3 minus a -3. We still have a +6. Where's that +6? a plus 6, okay, inside the lungs compared to this pleural space. So what is that doing to the lung? It's still pushing it out. So no matter if you're inspiring or expiring, what is that transpulmonary pressure? It is always pushing the lung out up against the wall of the thorax. So that's a good thing. So that's the point of this slide right here. That just the way things work, that transpulmonary pressure is always positive, and that keeps the lungs inflated, no matter if you're inspiring or expiring. Okay, so why do these pressures take place? Well, because of Boyle's Law. Here, Boyle's Law says that pressure is equal to 1 over the volume of a container. Now, is volume directly related to pressure? Or inversely related to pressure, according to Boyle's Law? I wouldn't write it like that. I would keep the dividing sign right here, right, put 1 up here, volume down over here. And so, what happens to pressure when volume increases? What's the relationship here? It is not directly related, it is inversely related, right? So just remember that. Boyle's Law says that pressure and volume are inversely related, so if we increase volume, what happens to pressure? Increase volume, pressure goes down, right? And so this is going to be the volume of our thorax right here, and then the pressure is just going to be pressure inside the lungs. Okay, elasticity. So we talked about surface tension. I want to get to, okay, this slide right here. I might go back to some of those previous slides, but I think I talked about some already. So here we have a nice plain film, an x-ray. The top x-ray right here just shows when somebody is at rest, what the size of the lungs are. So here is, all right, the right lung. Over here is the left lung. Left lung looks a little bit smaller. Would you expect that? This left lung looks a little bit smaller? Yeah. Oh, yeah, because the heart's right here. Good. I was wondering if that was accurate. Yeah, because here's the heart. Okay? When somebody's just at rest. So air is neither going in or out. And then when somebody takes a breath, right, this diaphragm, which looks like this when you're relaxed, now goes to this location down here. And remember, that pulls the lung with it. So now the lung scoots down all the way to this location as shown on the bottom plain film that we have. So here is the original size of the lungs. Here it is after we expand the thorax and contract the diaphragm. The lung volume increases by everything outside the dotted lines. Okay, so on inspiration, the lung volume increases. What happens to the pressure inside the lungs when the volume increases? Right, it decreases because it's inversely related. So pressure here is reduced. Atmospheric pressure stays the same. So now you have high pressure in the air, low pressure in the lungs. And which way does air go? Into the lungs when we expand the thorax. Okay, and I have a little bit of an example right here. Here is a make-believe lung. All right, so here's the wall of the thorax. Here is your trachea. That's your windpipe. So that's the way air can go from air in the room to inside the lungs. And the balloons, what do the balloons represent? Can you see the balloons? It's a little shiny, but I can sort of make it out. Yeah, those are your lungs. And then this black thing right here is your diaphragm. When the diaphragm is at rest, it pokes up into the thoracic cavity. It's dome-shaped like that, so I'm going to push it up into the thoracic cavity. And then when you breathe, what happens to the diaphragm? It flattens out. That increases the size of the thorax. And since the size increases, what happens to the pressure inside this little glass jar? It decreases. Pressure in the air stays the same, so you would expect air to flow into those balloons, right? So I don't think I need help. I might need help because I got to hold on to two things. So let's increase the volume by pulling the diaphragm down, and do you see the lungs inflate? And when we decrease the volume, you see the lungs deflate. And if we increase the volume, they inflate. Decrease the volume, they deflate because we're changing the pressure inside the thoracic cavity. So that's how air flows in and out, just like that. We have some other diagrams that show that. Okay, we're going to get to those diagrams quick, but let's look at some muscles. Here is that diaphragm. That's the most important muscle for inspiration because when it contracts, it goes all the way down to this level here. that increases the volume of the thoracic cage, decreasing the pressure so air goes in. Some other muscles that can be used for inspiration, because it elevates the rib cage laterally and maybe even anteriorly, and those will be the external intercostals, can elevate the ribs, sometimes the scalenes, and the sternocleidomastoid can elevate or at least act like an anchor point to pull up on these other ribs via the external intercostals. We got some parasternal intercostals here, which will also expand the rib cage laterally. And of course, parasternal means what? On either side of the sternum. That's one muscle I don't think we ever learned in anatomy, but they're there for inspiration. All right, so these are the muscles for inspiration. And here are some muscles for expiration. Expiration, the rib cage is going to be pulled back down. So the internal intercostals pull the rib cage back down, and all of these abdominal muscles are going to contract, forcing abdominal organs up into the thorax because the diaphragm is relaxing, and when all those organs get pushed up into the thorax, the volume of the thorax increases. Right, so on expiration, the volume of the thorax increases. What happens to pressure? What's that relationship once again? Inversely related. So when these muscles contract, the volume decreases. What happens to pressure? Inversely related. Pressure increases inside the lungs. Pressure out in the air stays the same. And so air moves out of your lungs as a result of that. Okay, so this is something that, here's another thing that we want to be aware of. There are basically two kinds of breathing. There's something called quiet breathing, and there is something called deep breathing or forced breathing. All right, so let's go back to quiet breathing. For quiet breathing, inspiration really just relies on the diaphragm. That's the most important muscle. Not so much these other muscles right here. And that's for quiet inspiration. For quiet expiration, this is really strange. It is completely passive. You don't use any muscles to expel air because there is enough elasticity in all of these tissues. So all you have to do is relax these muscles, and those elastic proteins that were stretched pull the alveoli closed, and the diaphragm goes back up to this location right here, and that's enough to force air out of the lungs, the elastic properties. So the alveoli have elastic fibers around them. You expand them when the diaphragm contracts. When the diaphragm relaxes, those elastic fibers then compress the alveolus. So I have two examples of an alveolus. Remember, alveolus is just a pocket that has air in it. Here is an example of an alveolus, right? I can make a pocket out of this paper bag, and here's a balloon, and this is going to be another kind of alveolus. One has elastic, the other doesn't. Which one has elastic properties? Yeah, the balloon does. All right, so let's fill air up in this paper bag. We're going to put some air in here, like so. And so this is inspiration of an alveolus that does not have elastic fibers. All right, so I trapped all that air in here. All right, all that air is in there, blew up the balloon, so the alveolus is now filled with air. And I want to relax, and what's going to happen to this air? I'll make sure that it's open right here. What's going to happen to all the air inside this paper bag? If I put it right here, open it up, like so, nice passageway right there. What happened to all the air inside that paper bag? It just stayed right there. It didn't move out. So if that's your alveolus, what's really bad is since this bag is already filled with air, you can't inspire any more air. You can't breathe any more air into your body because it hasn't collapsed. So even though you try to breathe, no air is going in your lungs, you're going to feel terrible about that. Okay. So here is another alveolus. Oh, good. It didn't pop. Sometimes they just pop. And I don't like, oops, sorry. I hate it when that happens. Okay, so here is another kind of alveolus. All right. And so we needed some muscles to get air in there. But if we relax muscles, all right, what's going to happen to air in here? Is it going to stay inside the balloon like this paper bag? Or is it going to get out? Yeah, it's going to get out, sorry. Okay, so which is a better model? What's a better model of, see if you can toss it. Oh, good. I'll get it. It's okay. I'll get it later. All right, so what's a better model of an alveolus, this paper bag or that nice rubber balloon? a balloon, right? Because it still has elastic properties. And if you lose those elastic fibers on your lungs and get lungs like this, then that's going to be terrible when that happens, right? So that's a terrible disease state. Okay. So for deep breathing, now you need some muscles for expiration. You need internal intercostals, all of the abdominal muscles have to contract, like the rectus abdominis, the transverse internal, external oblique, contract, forcing contents up into the thorax, decreasing the volume, increasing the pressure, and that helps you exhale. All right, so deep breathing is rapid breathing, rapid deep breathing, like hyperventilation, for instance, when you're exercising, which is different than the kind of breathing you're doing right now. Okay, so two different kinds of breathing. So here tells the story of how air moves in and out of our lungs. All right, so remember that when we looked at that transpulmonary pressure, oh, that was nice, I don't know what happened there, but it got bigger. That pressure is always going to be higher inside the lung compared to this pleural space, right, the intrapleural space. And that's just going to keep the lungs forced up against the chest wall. Let's see if that's really true. All right, so, oh, I know what happened. Nice. Okay, take a look at your slides. What is atmospheric pressure? Typically, it should be 760. Here I have a slide that's from a textbook that says 769. So that's a typo. It should be 760. What do you have in your notes? Did I have 69 or 60 there? It should be 60, okay? All right, so if it's not, just change it. So the air is 760 millimeters of mercury, and again, air is going to flow from high pressure to low. Atmospheric pressure is fixed. So at rest, we see the size of the lungs and the pressure inside the lungs, the intrapulmonary pressure is going to be equal to atmospheric pressure if you're just relaxed. So is air going to move in or out of the lungs if the pressure inside the lungs is 760 millimeters of mercury? And the pressure in the air is 760. What pressure is higher, 760 in the air or 760 in the lungs? It's the same. So is air going to move? No, air's not going to move, right? There's no pressure gradient. Right? But now let's look at this interpleural pressure. It is 756. Is that greater or less than the pressure inside the lungs? It's less, right? So that pressure difference is going to force the lungs up against the wall of the thorax, keeping the lungs inflated. They won't collapse. As a matter of fact, there's so much elastic tissue in a lung, if that pressure wasn't there, they would collapse to maybe the size of two fists, maybe even one fist. All right, it would just collapse down. All right, so what happens on inspiration? Atmospheric pressure stays the same. The diaphragm contracts. The size of the thorax increases, so the wall of the thorax pulls on the lung because it has that nice sticky fluid. But since the volume has increased, what happens to pressure inside the lungs? Yeah, it decreases because of Boyle's law. So now you have 757 millimeters of mercury inside the lungs, 760 in the air. So what's higher, 760 or 757? 760 is higher, so air flows in as a result of that. What about that pressure across the lung into the pleural space? Well, it's 757 inside the lung, like we said. And that intrapleural space drops even more to 754. So which way is this pressure difference going to affect the lung? It's going to push it up against the chest wall, like it should. All right, now on expiration, let's just say we just do this passively. We relax the diaphragm, goes back up to this nice dome shape, decreasing the volume of the lung. What happens to the pressure when volume decreases? Pressure increases, atmospheric pressure stays the same. Pressure inside the lungs goes up to 763, so what's a higher pressure, 763 or 760 in the air? 763 is a lot higher, so air is going to move out of the lungs, okay, when the chest wall, when the size of the thorax decreases. All right, so that is how we ventilate, how we move air in and out of our lungs, by changing volume, but make sure that there is no, oh, let's go back. Okay, let's go back to this condition right here. Let's just say that there was an injury to this person, and they got punctured, the wall of the thorax got punctured, so now This intrapleural space right here is no longer at 756 millimeters of mercury. If there's a puncture through the wall of the chest, what's the pressure in this intrapleural space? It becomes atmospheric pressure, 760. What's the pressure inside the lung? 760. There's no longer any pressure pushing the lungs out up against the thorax wall. And there's so much elastic tissue in this lung, as soon as somebody has a chest wound like that, the lungs are going to collapse. And when you expand the size of the chest, this pleural space is always going to be at 760 millimeters of mercury, so air is going to move in and out of this pleural space and not in and out of the lungs. So that's a really uncomfortable situation when that happens, because it's, you feel like you're breathing, but you're not breathing. Anybody know what that's called? That is a pneumothorax. And that can happen spontaneously or due to trauma to the thorax. All right, so this pressure in the pleural space always has to be less than pressure inside the lungs or atmospheric pressure. Otherwise, the lungs will collapse. We call that a pneumothorax. Okay. All right, so we're interested in knowing something about the lung. And we can do pulmonary function tests. We can breathe into a machine that measures the volume of our breathing. And I think you've done some of this in lab. And the machine that we use for that is called a spirometer. And the method of measuring lung volumes is called spirometry. Right? So we need a spirometer to get some spirometry. So here is a nice plot of lung volume versus when somebody's breathing in and out. And anytime you take a physiology class or a pulmonary class, you're going to look at this diagram. So that's why it is an exam figure, because it measures different volumes in the lung when you are breathing normally, when you take a really deep breath. So let's analyze this. So here we have lung volume. And what is the total lung volume of a normal person? What's the volume of a lung, both lungs? Is it 1 liter, 2 liters? This is cubic centimeters, right? So 3,000, 4,000, 5 liters? What's the volume of a normal lung? Almost 6, just less than 6 liters, okay? We see that right here. All right, so that's the maximum volume that the lungs can expand to. And when we are breathing normally, notice that we don't breathe anywhere up near that maximal volume. We're way down in the middle someplace. So we breathe in a little bit, we breathe out a little bit. This in and out motion is what we call tidal volume. And it's what? It's about 500 mLs, about half of a liter. So if you're just quietly sitting right there, that's how much air you're bringing in and out of your body. But if you're interested, you could get more air out of your body. At the end of an expiration, what can you do? You can even force a lot more air out of your body. This is what we call the expiratory reserve volume. This is below the tidal volume, right? But notice, does that go all the way down to zero? Does expiratory reserve go down to zero? It can't. You can't get all the air out of your lungs, no matter how hard you try. And that amount of volume in your lungs that's always going to be there is called residual volume. So that is kind of like a dead air space that's going to be in your lungs, unless something really heavy sits on your chest, like a elephant or something like that. Doesn't happen very often, right? Residual volume. All right, at the end of a normal inspiration, like this, what else can you do? You can go, you can take a really deep breath and really inflate your lungs, and this is what we call inspiratory reserve volume. That's above the normal tidal volume. All right, so if we add tidal volume, expiratory reserve, inspiratory reserve from here to here, this is the amount of air that we can really move in and out of our lungs to bring oxygen. So this is what we call the vital capacity. A capacity is just a sum of some of these simple volumes inside the lung. All right, so I'm not so interested that you know functional residual capacity, okay, but I do want you to know what vital capacity is. Right, and I don't really want you to know inspiratory capacity. I do want you to know all the volumes and vital capacity. So when somebody has pulmonary disease, guess what happens? Their pulmonary function decreases because this vital capacity goes away. And usually what happens is that this residual volume gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, And on top of that residual volume, you have some tidal volume, right? And if that residual volume gets so big, it starts to compress tidal volume way up over here, guess what happens? Then you need a lung transplant, right? Because you can't bring air in and out of your lungs because they're already filled with air. You can't bring new fresh air in. Okay, so this is an exam figure. Make sure you know what all these different volumes are. All right, so here is just some description of those different volumes from spirometry. Okay, we have to think about some things that affect the movement of gases from your body into air or into air into your body. And for diffusion, what are we interested in? What's the parameter we're interested in when we think about diffusion? Just the concentration of something, right? And how does something move by concentration from high concentration to low concentration? Well, a gas, we don't think of concentration, we think of pressure. And we could think of pressure due to a number of gases that are in a mixture. Like there's a certain pressure that's exerted by nitrogen gas. We have nitrogen in the air, there's oxygen and carbon dioxide. Each of these contribute to atmospheric pressure. So each of these little components we just call partial pressure. And all of these components right here usually add up to 760 millimeters of mercury. But what I want you to see with this equation right here is this pressure, partial pressure, is really a way to think about the concentration of a molecule. If we increase the pressure, partial pressure, that's like increasing the concentration of a solute in solution. So these compounds are going to move according to their pressure, from high pressure to low pressure. All right, and that's just Dalton's law. It says that the total pressure in this air is just going to be the sum of all the partial pressures of all the gases that are in that container, right? Nitrogen, oxygen, CO2. And there could be other gases in there, like, for instance, water. How could water be a gas? How could water become a gas? Because it evaporates into the air, right? And that evaporated water exerts a pressure on atmospheric pressure, so we have to take that into account as well. So as the humidity increases, the partial pressure of water increases, and if the atmospheric pressure stays the same, if water increases, then some of the other concentrations or pressures have to decrease in order to stay at 760 millimeters of mercury. So let's look at some of these pressures. Okay, so here we have an alveolus. Here we have air just in the room, air that we are inspiring. And water vapor sometimes is high, sometimes it's low, depending on humidity. In your lungs, it's always going to be pretty high because water is evaporating in this alveolus. CO2, the pressure of CO2 in the air is about 0.3 millimeters of mercury. You could consider that almost zero. And inside this alveolus, it's going to be 40 millimeters of mercury. So what's higher, 0.3 or 40? 40 is a lot higher, so which way is CO2 going to go? From air in the alveolus, okay, to this air that we inspire. All right, so just look at these partial pressures just like that to understand how these things are going to diffuse. All right, we talked about the surface area, that doorway for exchange of all those 300 million alveoli. Here we see that capillary network around the alveolus. But there's something that's missing from this diagram that you had in your anatomy book, which is something I don't want you to think about. It also showed a network of proteins that almost looks like this network of capillaries. Now, what kind of proteins are those? You already know, that form a network around this alveolus. It is these elastic proteins, right? So when this alveolus expands, when you relax, that network of elastic proteins collapses that alveolus back to its normal shape. Pulmonary circulation. Okay, remember that the pulmonary circulation is really short compared to systemic circulation. So since it's a lot shorter, the resistance is a lot less. So in order to keep the flow through the lungs same as the systemic circulation, then the pulmonary circulation should have a lot lower pressure because there's not so much resistance. Right? And the systolic pressure is about 15 millimeters of mercury in a pulmonary artery. And what's the highest pressure in a systemic artery, at least in a normal circumstance. What's the highest pressure? 120, right? So you can see the huge difference. And that's really helpful because when you have a capillary with high pressure in it, like maybe 100 millimeters of mercury, that's going to force a lot of fluid out of a capillary into tissue spaces, and that can cause those tissues to swell up. Well, we don't want our lungs to swell up or get filled with fluid because we want air going in there. So this lower pressure does not allow for a lot of plasma to leak out or other fluids from the blood into these pulmonary spaces. So that is really nice. That avoids pulmonary edema because of this lower pressure. All right, the other thing we have in these pulmonary arterioles, they constrict where there is low PO2, right? And they dilate where there is high oxygen. And I think I drew this on the board last time. Let's see if I can reproduce this. Now, I think you're going to find that to be a little strange, because we talked about local control for systemic circulation. Local control. And is this intrinsic or extrinsic regulation? Local control just means regulation that's happening right within the tissues, doesn't require any nerves, any hormones, or anything like that. So here we have systemic. And what's another circulation that you have? Pulmonary, right? Pulmonary, two different kinds of circulations. All right, and systemic, we just have, for instance, like a blood vessel right here, bringing blood to these cells. Let's just say that these are muscle cells, even though they maybe don't look like muscle cells. Here's that interstitial space. Okay, and when these cells are working, they absorb oxygen, and they release carbon dioxide, and when they're working, they might produce some lactic acid, for instance, so the pH changes in this space. So remember, at the entrance to every capillary, there is some smooth muscle that can constrict or dilate, and how does it move? This is what we had before. So if these cells are working, there is decreased oxygen, and what about CO2, if these cells are highly metabolic? CO2 is going to increase. Right, so there's increased CO2. Under either of these conditions right here, what happens to that precapillary sphincter? Is it going to relax and dilate, or is it going to contract and constrict this blood vessel? When there's low oxygen, would you like to have more blood going into this tissue or less? More, right? So under these conditions right here, both of these conditions, we would like vasodilation. Why vasodilation? Because that will allow more oxygen to get to these cells, and it will carry away more CO2. It will also, because if there's low oxygen, then you have more acid building up, like lactic acid. So vasodilation will get rid of that lactic acid, maintaining homeostasis in these tissues. Let's contrast this with the pulmonary circulation. All right, so here we got a blood vessel, right? And it's going to go to an alveolus right here. So let's consider the gases. We have oxygen and CO2 in this alveolus. And let's use the same conditions. Let's say decreased oxygen in here and increase CO2. What's going to happen to these precapillary sphincters in front of the capillaries that surround this alveolus? Should they vasodilate or vasoconstrict? What do they do for systemic circulation? They vasodilate. What about for pulmonary? They cause vasoconstriction. I want to write this out. All right, for the following reasons. Not all the alveoli in your lungs have the same oxygen concentration. All right, so some have high oxygen, some have low oxygen. Why would you want blood to go to an alveolus that has low oxygen? You don't. You want that blood to go to an alveolus that has high oxygen so that it can pick up oxygen, right? So this intrinsic control is exactly opposite compared to the systemic circulation. So when there's high oxygen in this alveolus, you don't vasoconstrict, you vasodilate, so a lot of blood goes to this alveolus to pick up oxygen. You see how that works? Okay. If there is low oxygen here, what happens to this precapillary sphincter? Low oxygen, it's going to vasoconstrict, so blood doesn't go to that alveolus because there's no oxygen there to pick up anyway. All right, that's an important thing. But here's something that's fascinating. When you have vasoconstriction, what happens to resistance to this vessel? When you constrict the vessel, what happens to resistance? It goes way up by the fourth power rule. Okay? All right, so when there is vasoconstriction, that does what to resistance? Oh, drastically increases resistance. Okay. Now, when do people have breathing problems and they don't even know about it? Because they're asleep. All right? And what do we call that? Yeah, sleep apnea. That's when people stop breathing when they're asleep. So when you stop breathing, what happens to oxygen concentration in this alveolus when you stop breathing? Does it go up or down, stay the same? It goes way down, right? So when you stop breathing at night, when you're asleep, this oxygen concentration goes way down. So what happens to this precapillary sphincter in the lungs? Oxygen goes down, vasoconstriction, that resistance increases quite a bit. And now what do you know about blood flow through that particular vessel? What's blood flow? Blood flow is equal to resistance divided by what? I mean, on top. Pressure, right? Pressure divided by resistance. So at night, when you stop breathing, that resistance increases, but you still need to have blood flow going through your lungs. What happens to pressure? If this goes up, in order to maintain blood flow constant, what has to happen to pressure? If resistance increases, to keep this the same, the pressure has to increase as well. So when somebody has sleep apnea, they have really severe hypertension, not in their systemic circulation, but in their pulmonary circulation. And that pressure can get so high that it can cause failure of the heart. But now what ventricle of the heart is going to be affected, the right or left ventricle? What ventricle pumps blood through the pulmonary circulation? That's the right ventricle. What pumps blood through the systemic circulation? The left. All right, so sleep apnea can cause heart failure of the right ventricle. That's the usual scenario. And it's really hard to measure pressure in the pulmonary circulation, right? Because where are those vessels at? Well, they're deep inside your thorax, so it's really hard to measure. How hard is it to measure systemic pressure, systemic artery pressure? Easy, because here's a systemic artery right there in your arm. It's really easy to measure. So sleep apnea can be deadly. So if you know anybody that snores a lot at night, wakes up, doesn't sleep, right, they could be damaged, they could be killing their heart as a result of that because of this matching of perfusion with ventilation. We call that ventilation perfusion rating. Right? And that has to do with local control of vasoconstriction or vasodilations of the blood vessels in the lungs going to those alveoli. Okay. Anybody follow that discussion? Sort of? Yeah? Was it interesting? Yeah, that should be really interesting. You don't really think about that stuff very much. Okay. What about control? Well, there's some interesting things with the respiratory system. Here we can see the brain stem, right? So it's nice cerebellum, cerebral cortex right here. And the brain stem has some important areas that can control respiration. Now, you do have voluntary control of respiration, right? Because we could hold our breath right now. Could you hold your breath right now? And we could make a pact that we would just hold our breath until we pass out, and then we would all pass out, okay? Because we can actually control that diaphragm. And then when we pass out, guess what would happen? You start breathing again, because there are some centers in the brain that can affect the respiratory centers, that can affect the diaphragm without your conscious thought, okay? So that's not such a big deal. And sometimes little kids do that to freak their parents out. They just hold their breath. Oh, you're laughing. Did you do that when you were a kid? No, you didn't do that. Okay. Probably somebody in here did. All right, so the diaphragm really is skeletal muscle under voluntary control, but you don't have to think about it every time because of the respiratory centers in the brainstem. and we see three of them. Here's the rhythmicity center. This thing acts like the sinoatrial node in the heart. What does the SA node do in the heart? It acts like a pacemaker. Yeah, so this area here just spontaneously depolarizes. That sends signals to the diaphragm to contract, right? And then it relaxes, repolarization. So this is the basic rhythmicity center in the brain, and that's in the medulla oblongata. And it works with a couple other centers. For instance, the apneustic area. Right here, that's in the pons. The apneustic area, maybe you should just draw a little arrow down over here to the rhythmicity center. The apneustic area right here acts as an accelerator. It enhances the pace of breathing. Right, so, and this rhythmicity center is getting information from other parts of your body, like what's the concentration of carbon dioxide or oxygen or acid in different parts of your body. That should control ventilation. So that's a positive influence on rhythmicity. And the pneumotaxic area right here is inhibitory on the apneustic area. All right, so draw a line with a nice negative sign right here. So these areas in the pons can either inhibit or accelerate respiration that is determined by the rhythmicity center. And these centers right here are connected to a bunch of receptors all over your body. Right? And since it's in your brain, they also respond to emotional stimulus as well. Okay, so what do we know here? All right, so inspiratory neurons stimulate spinal motor neurons, innervate the respiratory muscles like the diaphragm. Remember, expiration is when you're quiet breathing. What is expiration? You just relax. It's completely passive, right, because of those elastic properties all over the place. Right, so expiration is passive, occurs when inspiratories are inhibited, so those muscles don't contract. And, well, here, I already said this, apneustic and pneumotaxic area. Pneumotaxic antagonizes the apneustic center, right, and that's where you drew in that little negative sign. All right, so we said that things can affect those different centers, and those things are carbon dioxide, oxygen, and also acidity. Now, in order for your body to be able to measure CO2, oxygen, and pH, what do you need? In order for you to perceive light, what do you need? Yeah, in order for you to perceive me pinching you, what do you need? You need a receptor, right? You need a pressure receptor, you need a photoreceptor for light, and you need a chemoreceptor for these different chemicals. And you have two different locations. Basically, you have central receptors, and when I say central, we mean central nervous system. That's a central receptor. A peripheral receptor is in, not the brain, but somewhere out in the periphery. All right, so the central receptors are in the medulla. The peripheral receptors are in the carotid sinus, once again. That's where those baroreceptors are, and also in the arch of the aorta. And that's where you have baroreceptors as well. Okay, so these are the receptors for carbon dioxide, oxygen, and pH. And I think next time I'm going to start with this slide right here and talk about how these various chemicals regulate your respiratory rate without your conscious control. But you know what? I want to say one last thing. So here are the respiratory centers. What happens if somebody has a stroke? Right? Stroke is when some part of your brain dies. What happens if somebody has a stroke in one of these areas right here? Like the rhythmicity center and the apneustic center or a pneumotaxic center. That means they don't have automatic breathing. They still can't control their diaphragm because it's a voluntary muscle, but their diaphragm will never contract automatically. So when somebody falls asleep, what do they need? They need a machine to breathe for them, right? Because they don't want to stay up all night thinking about taking every single breath when that happens. Does anybody know what that condition is called? That's called Odin's curse. Odin's curse is when you can breathe only when you consciously think about it. Your autonomic breathing never takes over because this part of your brain has been damaged for some reason. Okay. All right. So that's all I want to say today. Sign-in sheet is going around. And we'll see you on Thursday.